History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. You've heard of the major land battles of the Civil War. Gettysburg, Chancellorsville, Antietam, First and Second Battles of Bull Run. But when it comes to naval battles of the Civil War, a lot of people think there's not much to say. Basically, the Union blockaded the Confederacy. They blockaded them from receiving supplies with their ports on the Gulf of Mexico and the Atlantic. And after Antietam, blockaded the Mississippi, and that's all there is to say. Well, it turns out that naval battles between the Union and the Confederacy did occur, and they actually occurred all over the world, everywhere from the Atlantic Ocean to the Caribbean to the coast of South Africa, the Indian Ocean, and even the South Pacific. And in the naval history of the Civil War, one of the most important ships was the Confederate raider Alabama. The CSS Alabama was a screw sloop of war built in 1862. It was built for the Confederate Navy, but actually constructed in Liverpool, England. It was a commercial raider and attacked Union merchant and naval ships over the course of a two-year career, sinking dozens and dozens of Union ships, even though it never docked once at a southern port. But it was finally confronted by the Union on June 19, 1864, after a 14-month chase that culminated in one of the most dramatic naval battles in history. Today's guest, Tom Clavin, is here to discuss the Alabama and this battle. He's the author of the new book, To the Uttermost Ends of the Earth, The Epic Hunt for the South's Most Feared Ship, and the greatest sea battle of the Civil War. The Alabama faced the Union warship Kearsarge in an all-or-nothing fight to the death, and the outcome effectively ended the threat of the Confederacy on the high seas. When the Kearsarge was tasked with finding the Alabama, its captain, John Winslow, was told, travel to the uttermost ends of the earth if necessary to find and destroy it. Winslow pursued the Alabama's Captain Semmes in a 14-month chase over international waters. Well, the Alabama lived on in folklore in the South, but also in unlikely places like South Africa, where it docked numerous times, and its captain and crew were greeted as heroes. It's a really unexpected and fascinating story that I think broadens our scope of how the Civil War was fought. I hope you enjoyed this discussion with Tom Clavin. Tom, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Glad to have you on, because I did a very long series with a co-host on the key battles of the Civil War, and we lightly touched on naval warfare, but couldn't go into it in any detail. So this is a great companion episode to that series, and a great story in its own right, as you'll get into much more here. So before we get into the story of the Alabama, I'd like to talk broadly about naval warfare and its role in the Civil War, which I think is criminally overlooked because it was a vitally important part of overall strategy for both the North and the South, especially the North, which used naval blockades from the Gulf of Mexico and the Mississippi River to deny critical resources to the Confederacy and force them to ultimately surrender. So broadly speaking, could you describe naval strategy of the Civil War for both the North and the South so we can understand how important the Alabama really was?
Well, when they talk about naval warfare in the Civil War, usually the entire subject is about the blockade. And once you've talked about the blockade, people move on to other aspects of the Civil War. But there was a bit of an international component to the Civil War on the water, because the South was blockaded and the blockade was enormously effective. There were blockade runners that successfully got through out of the southern ports or made their way into southern ports. But for the most part, from almost the very beginning of the war, the Union Navy was very successful in choking off, really, the ports of the main southern ports, Charleston, New Orleans, other places, Galveston. But the Confederacy, instead of just giving up completely and saying, okay, well, I guess that's over with, we can't do anything about that, they realized their only other option was to try and attack Union shipping on the high seas. And to do that, they needed a navy. Now, when the Civil War began, the South had no navy, basically. It had some old, rusty, used, and in some cases, scuttled ships. So what they had to do, and that's an important part of the book, The Uttermost Ends of the Earth, is how did they come up with a navy? How quickly could they do it? How could they pay for it? And what was the result of that? Because it was much more important that the South get out in the high seas, the oceans, and stop the Union ships in the ocean so that they never had a chance to reach ports like Boston, Philadelphia, New York, etc.
Something I'm surprised about with the Confederacy, and I have to give them credit, is how innovative they were with its naval technology. Now, I mean, the Alabama was somewhat modest, but reading about it had this telescopic funnel that could be raised or lowered to conceal it was a steamer. There's the story about the CMS Hunley, which I have a whole episode about, their submarine that was innovative, but also a horrible death trap. So probably the last place on planet Earth I would ever want to serve on. So let's talk about the Alabama and the innovative approach that the Confederacy used to conceal its status as maybe not a warship, but a vehicle used to harass maritime shipping. So tell me about the methods used to conceal the martial aims of the Alabama.
Well, the Confederacy, as I mentioned, needed a navy, but they didn't have the facilities in any of the southern port areas to build the kind of effective ships that they needed, the ones that could sail and steam very fast, that could carry a number of weapons, that would actually be able to defeat and, if necessary, sink Union ships. So what the Confederacy did is they had their agents over in England, and they paid this company, the Laird and Sons in England, to build a ship that would be, actually they built more than one, but just talking specifically about the Alabama, to build a ship that could go, it was a fast ship, a powerful ship. Now, the problem, of course, is that the Union also had their agents and representatives in London and in Liverpool and places like that. And they knew that this was what was going on, but officially, this was a pleasure ship, a yacht, you know, they by any other name. And it also helped that the founder of Laird and Sons, which is a great shipbuilding company, was also a member of Parliament. So he was kind of influential in throwing some of his own government off the scent. The British government, for the most part, neutral in the Civil War. I mean, ultimately, it sided with the Union because it waited to see who was going to win. But at that point, we're talking about 1861, 1862, they knew what was going on, that this was the ships that were being built for the Southern cause. But it provided jobs. It was money. It was they could turn a blind eye to it. Eventually, they had to pay attention to diplomatic protests. But by the time that got really serious, the Alabama was built. It could not carry any weapons because obviously, if you're building a ship and it's sitting there in port and it's starting to load it up with cannon, that's kind of a dead giveaway. So when the Alabama, which was not called the Alabama, it's called the 290 because it was the 290th ship built by the Laird Company, when it left the dock, it was, you know, officially going on a training or test sail to see how well everything worked. It just never came back. And a separate ship was put out that carried cannon, ammunition, things like that. And they rendezvoused basically on the other side of the world. And all the parts were put together. The cannon was loaded up, the other munitions, ammunition, everything like that. And suddenly the newly christened Alabama was a warship. And immediately it may well have been the finest warship in the world.
Can you describe the officer class from the Confederacy meeting the deckhands? And this is a very interesting international mix of people where you have a crew that may have almost no understanding whatsoever of the actual cause of the ship and what the officers are fighting for, but somehow they manage to get along. So could you describe how the crew meets its officers and how the whole affair manages to work successfully despite all expectation that it very well could not?
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that because the South had good naval officers. And you think, well, how's that? Because it didn't have a navy. But most of the attention when the Civil War began or was close to beginning was focused on the Army officers, West Point graduates and people like that, who had to make a choice. And many of them, you know, resigned their commissions in the United States Army so that they would be, you know, they could go home to Tennessee, they'd go home to Virginia and Mississippi, and then enlist as officers in the new Confederate Army. But what tends to get overlooked is you had a number of very fine, well-trained officers, or graduates of Annapolis, for example, who were serving in the Union Navy. It was United States Navy, of course, until the Civil War began. So when the time came, officers like Raphael Semmes, who was the commander of the Alabama, he resigned his commission in the United States Navy and returned to his home in Alabama. And he had John Kell, who was his first officer, and some of the other officers who served on the Alabama. You know, these were men with experience and training, intelligence. So as far as the officer class was concerned, the Confederacy was fortunate to have a lot of good, trained, intelligent, experienced men. Now, you talk about the crews. The crews are a different story. you know, we don't want to make it seem like on the Alabama, for example, the crew was filled with these men who were passionate about the Southern cause. You probably had a few, but let's face it, most of these fellows, and some of them weren't even American, you know, they were from Ireland, they were from the Caribbean, they were from elsewhere. It was a job. You know, that's what they did for a living, was they were sailors. And if they got hired, now, one thing the Confederacy did is that, this is how, in a way, the Alabama was able to put together a crew, is they offered real money. By that, I mean, they were going to pay the sailors in gold coin. And that made a lot more of an impression than trying to pay the sailors in Confederate money, which is, you know, almost from the beginning, virtually worthless. So you had these men band together as sailors. It really didn't matter terribly much if the flag was the stars and bars or the stars and stripes. They were bound to follow their officers' orders and to do the best they could for the safety and effectiveness of their ship. Because if their ship was successful, supposedly the way the formula worked, they in turn would trickle down economics was true of the Navy. You know, if the ship did well and sank other ships and was making off with booty and plunder, some of that would trickle down to the sailors. And presumably at the end of their voyage, they would be a lot better off than when the voyage began.
I read a short account about the Alabama, and there's a funny opening scene where Captain Semmes, he's making a speech about the Southern cause to the seamen. I mean, few of them are even American. So if he's talking about the sacredness of states' rights and the importance of slavery, I imagine two poor men from Liverpool looking at each other confused and shrugging their shoulders about what on earth he's talking about. But then when he mentions getting prize money for sinking ships, then everyone, their eyes light up, they start paying attention and then cheer loudly. Was it just money that held this crew together, or is it something else? Because it's never easy to hold a crew together. And we're talking a crew of enlisted men. These are men who are not necessarily or at all simpatico with the Southern cause. Yet the crew seems to work remarkably well. Is it just money, or is it something else that makes them all function so well together?
Well, that is kind of amusing because, like you mentioned, because here's Raphael Semmes giving this speech, as you mentioned, about the Southern cause and the sacredness of everything like that. And that's basically for him and his officers. The crew that's listening is like, well, okay, we'll perk up when something is of interest to us and relevance to us. And as you mentioned, when he mentions about money, the other thing he mentioned was they would have twice the usual allotment of rum. So that was very important to these men. Money and rum, you know, but that got their attention. Fine, let's go. Captain, we're yours. Take us where you want. But every ship is, in a way, its own country. The head of the ship is the captain. He has complete authority. You know, okay, every so often there's examples we've seen in history and popular novels and movies, you know, the Caine Mutiny and Mutiny on the Bounty, where a captain is deposed because he goes insane. But for the most part, captains, even if they, you know, neared insanity, they were still the ultimate authority. And so the crew of a ship really doesn't have any choice but to band together, work together, and follow their officers' orders. When you're out in the middle of the ocean, it's not like you can say, well, I kind of disagree with that, or can we discuss this? No, you can't. If you don't follow your orders, you end up in irons, and you could be court-martialed. You could be go through some kind. You could be hung if the captain so deems that your crime was egregious enough. So, you know, I don't want to make it seem like the crews of these ships during the Civil War were all for one and one for all, and you know, sang songs to encourage each other and to construct solid bonds between each other. The captain ruled every ship being a country, and the captain was the king. And if a crewman wanted to survive the voyage and perhaps, as I mentioned, come out of it with some money, they had to follow orders. And that's what every ship was like in the Civil War. And for the most part, you know, in the entire 19th century, there were few options open to a crew member who didn't quite agree or like a situation.
Well, nothing succeeds like success, and the Alabama does succeed. So that is a great explanation for how it keeps going. I'm interested in the early stages of its campaign of destruction in New England and then the Caribbean. So can you describe these early attacks and notable events that happened here?
Well, when the Alabama began its voyage in 1862, an enormous advantage it had, other than being a brand new, swift, and powerful ship, was that Union shipping had no idea that such a ship was out there. As far as they know, the southern ports had been blockaded. You could have the occasional fast little packet ship or whatever that could escape, but to have a warship out there that could freely roam the entire globe. And that, so the Alabama had the element of surprise for months and months and months until the reports started to go around. I mean, obviously you didn't have the kind of anything near the communication system we have today. So it would be months before ships in other places, parts of the world would find out about the Alabama. So when it saw a ship, it could swoop down upon that ship and could outsail just about anything it came across. And they would board the ship. And sometimes it was pretty easy. It was, as they say, low-hanging fruit, meaning you found the ship that was in a Union ship or American ship that was out of Boston or Gloucester or, you know, Philadelphia, wherever. And so what the Captain Semmes' crew would do is they would board the ship. They'd see what the cargo was. They'd take if there was anything useful. Otherwise, they would remove the crew from that ship and then burn it. And there's some heartbroken captains out there for the next couple of years, because a lot of times these captains were investors in their own ship, and they could be seeing their entire life savings being put to the torch. So the other thing Captain Semmes did, kind of a quaint hobby, maybe you would call it, but the prize he would take from a ship that he captured was the captain's chronometer. So after a couple of years, the Captain Semmes' cabin was filled with chronometers, because the Alabama actually stopped several hundred ships in the Atlantic and the Pacific. It didn't burn all of them, because some of them were registered as French ships or Spanish ships or whatever, so they couldn't be touched, neutral ships. But the other ships, the cargo was burned, and this was, over time, quite effective, because you were removing from the Union shipping lanes tons and tons and tons of goods that were either being shipped out to be turned into money, or were goods and the supplies that were being brought into the Union ports. So that kind of strategy to do that was effective for a good part of the Alabama's voyage, because until the reports started to get around, certainly get back to Secretary of Navy Gideon Welles in Washington, the Alabama was a bird of prey, and it could appear anywhere. In fact, one of the things that we talk about in the book is that after a while, among Union ships and all kinds of ships, there were sightings of the Alabama, you know, multiple times at the same day. Oh, the Alabama's off Spain. Oh, the Alabama's off Texas. Oh, the Alabama's off the Chinese coast. It became this almost like this ghost ship that could appear and attack at any moment.
One interesting thing I noticed about the Alabama when they raided is that they didn't harm captured ships, crews, or passengers. They just detained them on neutral ships or placed them ashore in a friendly or neutral port. Was this simply so they didn't have to, did they think that it would cause too much damage if they did harm the crew or cause the ire or anger of the Union against them? Was there any sort of strategy against this, or was this the most pragmatic thing they could do to not harm the crew when they took over a vessel?
Well, I think there's a couple of things to it. One is that with Raphael Semmes and his officers, they viewed themselves as gentlemen. So to take the officers of another ship and their crew members and harm them arbitrarily, or, you know, just because they could, was not an honorable thing to do. There was kind of like that code of honor in the Civil War among officers, even if they flew under different flags or sailed under different flags. So there was that aspect to it. You know, Semmes did not see himself as a cruel man. He saw himself as a Southern gentleman. So you treated other captains, other officers, and even crew members accordingly. But I think there was also the idea that, you know, if the word gets around that we're harming other officers, if we're, you know, we're going beyond the bounds of honor and conduct, then what's to stop Union captains and officers to do that to Southern officers and crew members or anybody that they were able to capture, whether on land or sea? So there was that kind of concern. And yes, it was a pragmatic thing that when you took a crew off a ship and then burned that ship, you wanted to find a place that they could be dropped off. And, you know, you didn't want them to be dropped off at some deserted island where they could starve to death or anything like that. But the nearest port, sometimes what Semmes would do, he'd track down a ship, stop a ship simply so he could unload his passengers. He might have two or three ships worth that have been burned of passengers on his ship, and things were getting rather crowded and dangerous. You know, you put enough Union officers and crew members on your ship, they may be able to overwhelm, you know, your crew. So The idea was to get them off your ship as soon as possible, get rid of this problem, and go on to the next ship.
One thing I want to focus on before we look at its overall mission is the technology of the vessel itself. When the Alabama is constructed, this is an interesting transitional point with naval technology where we're moving from the age of sail to the age of steam. Now, of course, technological change doesn't happen in an instant. You don't go overnight from ships being sail to every single dock producing steamers, much like now. We still have plenty of gas-powered Toyotas as Teslas are starting to roam the highways. And the Alabama is a bit of both. It's both a sail ship and a steamship, too. Could you describe its technology?
It was a transitional ship. Now, there were, I think, if anything, what the Civil War on the water pointed out is that there was no going back to sail being the primary way that you powered a ship. You know, steam showed itself over and over and over again as the future for shipping. And the Alabama had the ability, and I mean, it had sails, of course, and it was a very swift ship, even just under sail. But if you combine that with the steam power that it had, it was a thoroughbred. It was a very fast horse on the water. And so now one issue, though, that is important to note, which was of bedeviled ships in the Civil War, is because you're relying more and more on steam, you had to have coal. And so, you know, conceivably, if you have a ship that's powered by sail only, you could roam the entire earth and for weeks and weeks and weeks at a time, as long as you found the right wind, it could keep going. But you couldn't do that with a steamship because, you know, it ate coal at a rapid rate. And so it was something like, you know, your ship could have the speed of a Ferrari, but in other ways, it was a Humvee. You know, you had to go from gas station to gas station. You had to go from port to port to keep replenishing your coal stocks. So that was something that the Alabama had to face. Yes, with the combination of sail and steam, basically, I mean, a little more than that, but you could flip a switch. It's sort of like a hybrid car between electric and gas. You know, it was a great ship and a very powerful weapon that the South had, and the North had their steamships too, of course. But there came a point where if your coal stocks were getting low, it didn't matter what your mission was. It didn't matter how many other ships were out there just waiting for you to track them down. You had to get to a port and get replenished.
Hey, everyone. Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. The Alabama went on 7 expeditionary raids, and it's surprising to see where it goes. It goes to South Africa, to the Indian Ocean, to the South Pacific. Why does it go all over the earth when essentially it's part of a conflict between North and South on the North American continent? And which events of these raids do you think were the most consequential?
Well, there was the battle with the USS Hatteras, which was actually a warship, a Union warship that the Alabama sunk. And it was really the only time until the climactic battle of the uttermost ends of the earth, which is when it confronts the USS Kearsarge. It was the only time that it met another warship and engaged in battle. Otherwise, the raids were all on, for the most part, commercial shipping. But the two reasons why we chose the title of the book, To the Uttermost Ends of the Earth, one is that it's a direct quote from Gideon Welles, the Secretary of the Navy, who instructed the captain of the USS Kearsarge, you go to the uttermost ends of the earth, track down the Alabama and sink it. That's your mission. But the other reason is because the Alabama really did go to the uttermost ends of the earth. You know, earlier on in its mission, as I mentioned before, it was kind of easy pickings because it just patrolled the main shipping lanes in the Atlantic, and it could encounter and sink all kinds of ships, and in the Caribbean. But once the word got around, the Alabama was out there, you know, ships were taking different courses. They were running in packs to better protect each other. So the Alabama found, and Captain Semmes said, we have to cast a net that actually would cover the entire world. It started to go into the Pacific. It visited Vietnam. It visited what later became Saigon. It was in the Indian Ocean. So I think that's one of the most remarkable aspects of the story is that the Alabama became an international event, so to speak, because a ship carrying Union cargo or cargo bound for New York or Philadelphia could just be leaving a port in the Philippines, for example, and think, okay, we're not having any trouble here. And also the Alabama appears off the Philippines or off the coast of Africa. So I think that the Alabama was kind of like a shark in a way. It had to keep swimming or it dies. The Alabama had to keep moving, especially as the war went on and more ports were closed to it. You know, other countries, many other countries that were basically being neutral in the Civil War, as the war went on and it was more clear the Union was winning, they started to close their ports to any Confederate ships. Not that there were many of them. There was the Alabama and a handful of others. And so that made it harder for the Alabama to replenish their coal, give their crews a break, even give the captain a break. I mean, his first lieutenant, John Kell, I think he was on the Alabama for 2 years before he left the Alabama. And, you know, part of that, a big part of that was his own dedication to the cause and especially to his captain. But the Alabama really was a ship that went to the uttermost ends of the earth.
It also becomes a legend in surprising places. It lives on in the South in folklore, which you could mention here or toward the end, but also in South Africa, which I thought was very interesting.
Yeah.
How does it live on in the folklore there, and why did it capture the imagination in South Africa?
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned South Africa, because when the Alabama first put in there at a couple of South African ports, Semmes was lionized as a hero. There was, you know, the South Africans who would later have their own independence issues, and there was the Boer War, for example, that took place a few decades later. There was a certain kind of admiration for the Southern cause, the upstarts that the Southerners were, and trying to chart their own course and fulfill their own destiny, so to speak. So when the Alabama put in, Semmes was a celebrity. And he was feted, and there were dinners for him and everything, and he was cheered by crowds. Later on in the war, when the Alabama returned to South Africa, it was a bit of a different story, because one thing was the word had gotten around that the South was in trouble. But also in South Africa and a few other ports, Singapore, for example, the effectiveness, the success of the Alabama put a damping on international commercial shipping in general. You know, if sugar brokers could not get their sugar to the United States, the Union ports, and sell them, they were having a hard time. And that ripple effect affected the entire country. So it was South Africa is a good example of that. Earlier in the war, the Alabama was welcomed there as a symbol of the independent, spunky spirit of the Confederacy. But later in the war, as the Alabama, much more tired and needing of repairs and everything, would limp into a South African port, Semmes was not viewed as an enemy, for example, but the enthusiasm was gone. The thrill was gone as far as South Africans were concerned with the Alabama.
Toward the end of its expeditionary voyages, how does it manage to keep going? Does it go to smaller ports, or when people who are either welcoming them with less open arms or not welcoming them at all, how do they continue toward the end of their mission?
It's really pretty amazing that the Alabama lasted as long as it did as a powerful bird of prey, as I mentioned before, that expression, because its voyage lasted, you know, more than 2 years. There were, especially earlier in the war, ports it could go into, not only just to resupply, replenish its coal and fill its supplies and do repairs, but as the months and months and months dragged on, there was just a lot of wear and tear on the Alabama. Some of it was weather-related. Some of it was just the way, you know, if you're sailing in the ocean for months and months at a time, there are things that are going to happen to your hull. You're going to need sails that get torn in storms, and there's only so many times you could fix a sail. You can sew it back together. You might need a new sail. There's even one point in the book where they basically put in, not at a port that had facilities, but they basically, you know, they create a diving bell, so to speak, in which some of the crew members go underwater to work on the hull from under the water, and they have to keep coming up and, you know, get some more oxygen, go back down. It's really quite remarkable. So the Captain Semmes and his crew really had to innovate and find every way that they could. Now, eventually, as we get later into the book, it becomes clear that the Alabama's days are numbered. They can't, you know, there's certain things that are breaking or failing. They just can't replace. They would have to go to a port that's used to repairing ships. And by this point, for the most part, those ports are not open to any Southern ship anymore, and certainly not to the Alabama. And that's, you know, eventually what happens is that Semmes is, you know, he takes a big chance by putting it in Cherbourg in France. This is in June 1864. he's, you know, his boat is at some point going to just be dead in the water because he just can't sail anymore. You know, the engine, steam engine is going to break down. Even the sails are too shredded to go any place. So he takes a gamble by going into Cherbourg. One thing being that this French port is one of the very few that would still allow him to come into port. And he's hoping that he could spend some time there doing some much needed repairs and go back out again and be an effective ship again, because otherwise it would not have. It would have had to be taken out of service. And it turns out that putting in at Cherbourg was it was like unavoidable, but that was the beginning of the end for the Alabama.
Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors. The Union chases it for approximately 14 months. How is it finally able to locate the Alabama? Is it because it's in port and vulnerable, or were they able to get intelligence that allowed it to track it more easily? Because when we're talking about transoceanic voyages, a lead on a few days can't really help. You have to be tracking it for weeks and weeks at a time, and information travels much more slowly.
As the Alabama became more dilapidated, it became easier to try and track it down. Another part of it is, yes, as you mentioned, word started to get around. I mean, telegraphs were being used then, and so word began to spread of Alabama sightings. But I think this is where we have to give credit to the captain of the Kearsarge, John Winslow, who in the past, when there have been stories told about the Alabama, he tends to be overlooked. He's sort of like a footnote. But in the uttermost ends of the earth, he finally gets his due. He was a very intelligent man. He was very challenged. I mean, he had all kinds of physical challenges. But as you say, he was the captain of the Kearsarge that for 14 months chased the Alabama. But he also figured out that what previous other Union captains had done that was a mistake is when they would hear about the Alabama having attacked ships, let's say off the coast of Haiti or something like that, they would race their ship to Haiti. Well, by the time they got there, the Alabama was hundreds and hundreds of miles away. They were always reacting to something that had already happened. Winslow tried to anticipate where the Alabama would go. Where has it been? Where has it not been? Well, then it may be going there. So eventually, it was a combination of the Alabama having fewer and fewer places that it could go, and Winslow figuring that out and paying more attention. I mean, when he heard that the Alabama was in, let's say, European waters, there are obviously some ports that he didn't, and countries he didn't have to bother with because they were no longer welcoming Southern ships. So it occurred to him that France was a good place to check out, and that's how it happened that, you know, he got word that the Alabama was in Cherbourg, and then he got his ship to Kearsarge there as soon as possible. And this time, when he arrived, the Alabama had not left; it was there in port.
What happened at the Battle of Cherbourg?
Well, there didn't necessarily have to be a battle off the Cherbourg between the Alabama and the Kearsarge, because Captain Semmes and his officers could have surrendered their ship with honor. And what I mean by that is, let's face it, they had spent more than 2 years roaming the globe doing something that no other warship had ever done before. And they knew that their ship was badly in need of repairs. So why do it? I mean, but they, again, I think it was something like about honor. They were not just going to surrender their ship. They were going to basically fight to the death for the cause that they believed in. Now, by this point, the crew was pretty much on their side as far as, yes, we're with you, Captain. You know, we've been with you for over 2 years now, one for all for one. And yes, thank you. You've given us plenty of rum, like you promised. They didn't make much money as they were promised, but they had their rum. So that's when Sem sent a message out to the Kearsarge at Winslow that we're coming out and we're coming out to fight you. And Sem's told his officers, I think we can beat the Kearsarge. Now, deep down in his soul of souls that he believed that, we don't know. He knew that the odds were very much against them. But he decided that it was sink with honor rather than surrender with honor. So that Sunday, June 19th came along in 1864, and the Alabama left the port at Cherbourg, and it went out to international waters because France wouldn't allow any fighting in its waters. And it met the Kearsarge. And it wasn't a very long sea battle. It wasn't like it lasted for hours and hours and hours or days or anything like that. But it was really quite intense. You know, I kind of compare it to most people know about the gunfight at the OK Corral. That gunfight lasted all of 30 seconds, that entire gunfight. But in that 30 seconds, there was something like 30 or 35 shots exchanged. And the battle between the Kearsarge and the Alabama lasted about an hour. But during that time, you know, these ships were maneuvering with each other. It was broadside after broadside. There were men being killed. The Alabama decks ran red with blood. The officers were injured. Semmes was slightly wounded. And eventually got to the point where basically the Kearsarge, which was in much, much better shape, and by this point a much faster ship, wore the Alabama down. The Alabama started to sink. And Semmes' next priority after that was the safety of his crew, his officers, and ultimately himself, although I think if it had worked out that way, he would have gone down with his ship. He happened that he did not.
Afterwards, what happened to Semmes, his crew, and his officers?
You know, we don't know too much about what happened to his crew. They were taken prisoner. They were picked up by the Kearsarge and its rescue boats. The Kearsarge probably did was just drop them off because it didn't really, I mean, it really wasn't going to transport the crew all the way back to the United States and put them in Union prisons. With Semmes and his officers, Kell and a couple of others, they were picked up by a British pleasure boat, the Deerhound. And the owner of the Deerhound transported Semmes and his officers to England, where they rested up. Semmes spent the summer of 1864, partly in England and partly as a tourist, you know, going to some certain places in Europe. Eventually, he made his way back to the South, and he was put in charge of the James River Squadron, which was basically an inshore squadron. But this was in the latter stages of the war. So the James River Squadron didn't have much life left in it. It was eventually disbanded. Semmes was even commissioned a general in the Southern Army for a short time. But then the war ended. And after being away from his wife and children for, I think, close to 4 years, he finally returned home to his wife and his kids.
What would you say is the legacy of the Alabama? And what do you hope readers take away from your book?
Well, I think one thing I hope they take away is it's really an adventure story. You know, the uttermost ends of the earth is about not just one ship, but two ships, the Kearsarge II, that one chases the other all over the planet, literally all over the globe. And it's an adventure story of the Alabama's experiences. It's an adventure story of the Kearsarge's experiences. It's a thrilling story about when these two ships meet in a great sea battle in which only one could survive. There was no way that they were going to break off and say, okay, nice battle, we'll see you next time. Only one ship was going to still be afloat when that battle was over. And I think that the other thing about it is that there is, for the most part, an untold story about the Southern Navy. You know, again, when we began our discussion, you know, we talked about the blockade being usually the beginning, middle, and end of a story about naval warfare and the Civil War. There was that other component where the Alabama and several other Southern ships were able to break free and sink Union shipping. For at least a couple of years there, they were quite effective. The greatest of them all was the Alabama. But mostly I think people will really enjoy a 19th century Navy story that they otherwise might never have knew existed.
There's a lot more details here that we couldn't get into in this discussion. And for listeners who want to learn more, the name of the book is To the Uttermost Ends of the Earth, The Epic Hunt for the South's Most Feared Ship and the Greatest Sea Battle of the Civil War. Tom, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. I'm really glad to be here.
All right, that is it for today. If you would like to see show notes for this episode, along with all my others, go to ParthenonPodcast.com. That's the name of the podcast network that I'm a part of, along with James Early's Key Battles of American History, Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen and History of the Papacy, and other great history shows as well. If you'd like to support History Unplugged, the two easiest ways to do so are to subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. The second way is to join our membership program, and if you do so, you'll get completely ad-free episodes of the entire back catalog, which is 600 episodes and growing. Just go to patreon.com/unplugged. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.